Strategy and Insider, exploring future trends and their impacts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Strategy and Insider podcast, focusing on the future of health. We're thrilled to celebrate really a milestone today. This is our 30th episode since we launched back in 2019. Our entire podcast team is incredibly proud of the progress that we've jointly made with all the diverse, profound, but also fascinating conversations that we've made in the last month and years. And we're just getting started, to be honest, because this podcast remains one of the most cherished projects that we're having here in Strategy and Pharma Life Sciences. So that said, stay really tuned for an exciting lineup of episodes featuring fantastic guests, one of them being with me today here in sunny Berlin. Joining me is a distinguished expert in women's health, gynecology, and obstetrics, talking about Professor Dr. Mandy Mangler. Mandy is a medical director and chief physician for gynecology and obstetrics at Vivantes Auguste Victoria Clinicum since 2016. And in addition to that, she also serves as the chief physician for gynecology and obstetrics at Vivantes Klinikum Neukölln since January 2021, which is also located in Berlin. And since 21, she is also a professor of women's health and obstetrics in the midwifery science program at the Protestant University of Applied Sciences. Previously, Mandy worked in gynecology and obstetrics at the Charité in Berlin for almost 12 years. And the Charité is obviously one of the largest university hospitals here in Europe with more than 3,000 beds. Her dedication has earned Mandy several accolades, including the Berlin Women's Prize 2022 and also the Order of Merit of the State of Berlin in 2024. Many of you may know her as the host of the Gyncast podcast, which addresses women's health issues and has over 1 million downloads since 2022. Her podcast actually covers topics like childbirth, contraception, and also women's health by and large. In October 24, she also published her first book called The Big Gynecology Book, which is dedicated to all areas of women's health from the very first menstruation to menopause and also into old age. As you can tell, we have really a true trailblazer with us today, and I'm excited to welcome such a versatile but also esteemed expert in women's health and explore topics that are new to our podcast. So that said, a very warm welcome, Mandy. It's really a pleasure to meet you here in one of your clinics today.
What an introduction, and thank you for that, and I'm happy to be with you.
Yeah, thank you. And as rightly said, it's a very impressive introduction. And your path into gynecology was kind of, if you look at from an outside, rather straightforward from studying medicine in Berlin and to significant roles in major Berlin clinics. What initially, if I may ask, drew you into this field? Was it always very clear that gynecology is what's calling for you?
No, I knew I wanted to do something in surgery. I wanted to operate on patients. As a physician, you always decide between internal medicine and then surgery. And so I knew that. But then, like normal surgeries, I don't know, it did not appeal to me like that. And then I realized as I studied that I really like women. I like working with women. And there's the possibility in gynecology to operate and to use your intellectual skills to treat a patient, right? And that was, yeah, that seemed to be a very good idea to me. And also, you have some political aspects of gynecology, and those political aspects I found very interesting and also important. And that's when I decided to go into gynecology and obstetrics.
And I'm sure we'll come to some of those elements mm-hmm. that intrigued you into the field later in the conversation. Yes. And as you have lived, studied, worked in Berlin, it must be something special for you. Yeah? So probably you can talk also a bit about Berlin, what makes this so personally attractive for you, but also talking about kind of world-class medicine. Everybody mm-hmm. kind of aims to develop a hub for world-class medicine, and Berlin certainly is one of the hubs that stands out here. Can you also elaborate a bit on what makes Berlin special with regard to medical research, but also innovation as compared to other European hubs?
Yes, well, Berlin is a very beautiful city. You can just be yourself in Berlin. That's very nice. And it's very diverse and it's lively. And also we have a very intense medical structure in Berlin. We have the Charité, which is obviously a very big center of the city medical-wise. But then we have so many structures that all work together. And in general, we have a very specialized synthesis of those medical structures. And that's very nice because you can do big projects and you can, you know, collaborate with many. And you have the RKI, you have so many institutes that all can collaborate that you can, yeah, do big studies. And it's very appealing.
I was just intrigued to ask that because you mentioned the Robert Koch Institute, right? Mm-hmm. So this is located here. This is where it happens. This is where the decisions are taken. That's why interesting to look into that. If I can just come back to your podcast, because in that you empower women also with knowledge about their own bodies and sexuality, and also to advocate for themselves in healthcare. You mentioned in one of the episodes that you have been shocked by the inequities women face still in medicine today. What is, from your perspective, most significant misconception about women's health, and what can we do to dispel?
Mm-hmm. Well, we have medicine is like very standardized thing. So we examine patients and then we plan therapies. And the patients that we examine, we use in our studies, for example. And women were not included in studies previously. Only for a few years, women are probands in studies and take part of these studies. And we are able to conclude from women's symptoms to their therapy. And just a few years ago, we thought women are just small men and we can treat them alike. But we came to the point where we understood that's incorrect. And now we know we need to individualize our therapies, not only for women, but for other patients as well. We're coming from this evidence-based medicine, which is very strong and I really like, because we look at studies and say, for 1,000 people, this therapy was very successful, so it might be really good for you. But then again, this might be the only person which would not profit from this therapy. So now we move on. We take our evidence-based medicine and take it to an individualized concept. We look at the person and do our N1 study with this person only. And we take our big studies and conclude like an individualized, personalized therapy from that. And that's a very strong moment in medicine, I think, because we use big data to gain benefits for the individual patient. And that's very strong, I think.
And if we look N equaling one, and also back a few episodes, we discussed with Professor Bernd Bodenmüller and Andreas Wicki around personalization of oncology care, and also kind of big hopes there and big leaps that we've seen. Is that yet to come in gynecology, or do you see already benefits for individuals stemming from N equaling one diagnostics, decision making, and treatments?
We have taken big steps, for example, treating breast cancer patients. Mm-hmm. If you have breast cancer, all your data is put into one big data bank and everything that concerns your tumor and your age and everything. And then you get an individualized therapy concept. And that's very strong. But then again, in other parts of medicine or of gynecology, we have not come so far. So we do not know about endometriosis, how to diagnose it, about PCO, about fibroids. Those are all gynecological diseases. And there we lack information, we lack studies. We have not had enough studies to know things. We have not invested in studies. There's a lack of money also in funding. So we have come far, but we can definitely invest some money in gynecology or family medicine or also children's medicine. Mm-hmm. That's the same.
Very true. And if I can just come back one moment to the inequities still, mm-hmm. because that was kind of one of the questions earlier. Despite 77%, so 3 out of 4 gynecologists are women. Mm-hmm. The field does remain somewhat male dominated, yes, if you look at it from an outside perspective, especially when it comes to leadership, professional associations, research and the alike. And this may certainly have implications on women's health, such as the inclusion of certain female body parts from medical discussions, or also the stigmatization of menstruation and menopause. Mm-hmm. Yeah? That said, you are active in the field, you are seeing this, you are part of associations, you are part of the clinical realities day to day. What changes are needed in, let's say, medical education, in gender data and others to address this issue? And ultimately, what can lead gynecology in a truly feminist approach?
Mm-hmm. I think at the moment we have the standardized patient, and this is a male patient, and mm-hmm. we conclude from this standardized patient everything else to women and to other diverse people. And so we need to change that. We need to, in medicine generally, but in gynecology as well, we need to really look out of the perspective of the patients, of women, for example, and ask them, what do you want from medicine? Quality of life, longevity, you know, everybody would say something else. And that's also where PROMS and PREMS come in the game. PREMS and PROMS are patient-related outcome measurements and mm-hmm. patient-related experience measurements. So we now in medicine start to ask the patients about their needs and about what they want and how they understand quality of medicine. That's new. And I sometimes wonder why we did not do that before. So this is one thing we need. We need to really look out and take the perspective of the patients. And of course, all the leading positions should be diverse. They should not Absolutely. Be just taken from male leaders. But we should ask us to have diverse leaders who really reflect our society as such and not just one prototype of people. This would be something. And then, of course, I think funding should generally need to also address gender perspectives. Mm-hmm. So funding should clearly ask, is this study really individualized, personalized, taking gender aspects into account, or is this, you know, another standardized approach we might have had before? So this would be my three answers.
I just want to echo that it's so important to understand what the individuals want. Mm-hmm. We recently also ran a study around longevity and preventative measures, and we asked the general public in Germany and other countries about the importance of preventative measures and what they would be doing for it and paying for it and blah, blah, blah. And then we also asked, why do you actually do this? Why do you want to have preventative measures? And we gave them a scale ranging between, I want to extend my life as much as I can, yeah, versus the other end of the spectrum, I just want to live my life to the fullest, no matter how long it is, right? And it was literally kind of a 50-50 split. So you mm-hmm. could not go just to the right mm-hmm. or just to the left, mm-hmm. but you need to really ask and dig into it. Otherwise, you're taking measures that are against the wishes of individuals. Yeah?
It's interesting, yeah. isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah? Because many times we just take longevity into account. We say, okay, this we have as an aim, people should live as long as they could. But, you know, to what account do they live, or do they have a good quality of life? Do they want to live that long?
Yeah.
And those are important questions.
It is. Yeah. Mm. And I was mentioning that you recently published a book where you share very insightful perspectives on topics like female pleasure, menstrual health, contraception, but also reproductive issues, all with the aim to empower women through, as you mentioned before, evidence-based information, so you can take really an informed choice. Given that sexual education can be also challenging for many parents, what is your ideal approach to fostering a self-determined understanding of someone's body and sexuality? Because you are in a luxury position to seeing mm-hmm. patients pre-birth, yeah, mm-hmm. when they are still part of the mother's body, mm-hmm. so to say, through to birth, through to first menstruation, menopause, and old age. How do you start that dialogue best?
Well, I think out of my perspective, women are great. You know, women have so much, so much power. You know, they go through the cycle, which is the origin of our life and the origin of our society. Even then, they might give birth, and that's a very strong process. And then they raise families, children, and then they, you know, might go through menopause. And those are all aspects that make women so strong out of my perspective. And yet they are expected to be very giving, and they do a lot for others always. And they, yeah, they are educated like that. Society expects this from women, to be there for others and to kind of neglect also their own needings and wants, and also sexual pleasure. So sexuality is a very good example, I think, because when we think about sex, we think about a very male perspective. For example, we think the penis and vagina, they fit together and those are sexual organs. But the truth is, the penis and the clitoris are the sexual organs. So anatomically also, and the penis and clitoris are equivalent organs. But, you know, for example, little girls, they are taught that the vagina is important. But the vagina is a very boring organ out of a woman's perspective, which does not mean that, you know, the sexuality should not include penetration. But clitoris and penis are the important orgasm organs. And that's what we sometimes forget. And also women do not focus on that. They might not know because they are not educated. Even in medical books, the clitoris is neglected and not drawn or not shown. Or, you know, I took one of my favorite anatomy books, and there was a small paragraph about the clitoris, which consisted of three sentences. And then I looked up the penis, the equivalent organ, and it had three pages. And I felt really bad, because that's not really nice.
No, that's not in sync by any means. Probably moving from there to another delicate topic, abortion. And you recently also advocated for the legalization of abortion, not through deregulation, but by removing it from the penal code.
Yes.
The current legal framework deems abortions illegal, but exempt from punishment under certain conditions. But by and large, this can obviously cause stress to both practitioners and patients. Knowing that other countries handle it differently, what are the lessons learned that can be drawn from there, from countries that are more liberal in this policy? And is there kind of a framework that, that one could propose for a more autonomous approach of women and couples to this?
Yeah, that's very interesting, because, you know, I understand Germany is a good country, strong country. But then I look at, yeah, female autonomy or abortion rights. And then I feel bad, because we're very conservative. If we look at other countries, they are way more liberal and in favor for female rights. For example, France, UK, Netherlands, Canada, to just mention a few. And from these countries, we know if you have legal abortion rights, which we do not have in Germany, so it's illegal to have an abortion for non-medical reasons in Germany, always, under all conditions. So if we look at other countries where it's legal, we do understand that this does not raise abortion numbers, or this does not make strange situations where a woman in maybe close to birth says, I want to have an abortion. This does not happen. So we should really consider to legalize abortion, because it's a very strong democratic tool for women. If you have legal abortions in a country, that's a very democratic sign, because you let women decide over their own body, unlike deciding for them and to take power from them. So abortion rights do reflect democracy for me. Mm-hmm. And so that's something we can work on in Germany. Definitely.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for sharing that. Yeah. And I mean, it's hard to have any discussions in the German health sector without at least probing a little into health economics. And in Germany, you are legally obliged to have a health insurance, whether it's statutory or private. And for most part, German women have access to services ranging from pregnancy care to women's cancer screenings. However, there are still some barriers in at least statutory health insurances, where, for example, there is incomplete coverage of birth control, fertility treatments, or even ovarian cancer screens. For truly self-determined women's health care, these should be covered by insurance, if you ask me. But how can you make such a comprehensive women's and reproductive health care affordable and bring that kind of to the choice of women?
Yeah. That's a very good question, where I have, you know, many ideas how to improve our healthcare system, because, you know, as a person who works in our healthcare system, I really do like it, of course, and I think it's a very strong system, even though it's in wild fields, irregulated, you know, it's just, you know, anarchy. So we need to take a look. How can we, you know, improve it? And for example, we still don't have any digitalization, which would really improve the situation. I can go to a doctor and he takes my blood, and then I go to the next one, he does it again, and then I get CT scans, and, you know, they are all not connected. I cannot see what kind of blood my colleague drew or the CT scan from some other person. And that's really, really awful. So it's wildly irregulated. And therefore, we lose money every day, all the time. And we also do examinations that are not needed. Mm. And we just do them because we think we should do something for the patient. And it does not make any improvement of their health, you know. So we can, if we talk about even, you know, paying more or providing, for example, birth control, which would be additional costs. We need to look at the costs we already cause, and we do invest the most money in Europe in our healthcare system in Germany. And yet we do not have the best outcome of healthcare. So we need to also take a look at that. With all that money that we invest, how can we have a stronger healthcare system? So there are so many aspects to that. And I really like it because, you know, it's an everyday question. We can all do something to have a better healthcare system. We can, you know, stop drawing blood every day from the patients. We can start to always reflect on the examinations we do. And for example, also expensive laboratory examinations, yes, or expensive treatments, are they really good for the patient? And how can we, yeah, how can we have a healthy patient and still do not have anarchy in our healthcare system?
So, and what I'm hearing, and I'm also echoing this at the same time, it's not only or always about spending more, but spending mm-hmm. the money that we spend rightly. Yeah,
so yeah, smart.
Getting smarter in terms of not repeating CT scan after CT scan yes. without knowing from each other. Yeah, or blood after blood example yeah. from each other, connecting data more swiftly mm-hmm. and. Through getting more effective, efficient there, being able to spend in other areas where it's mattered most.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that said, right, staff shortages and limited time for individualized care are really common challenges for anybody, also for mothers giving birth in hospitals. Yeah? In light of those rising costs that we're seeing, but also personal issues with staff shortages, as I said before, how can we actually ensure women have a self-determined birth experience when there is a birth to be expected? And probably starting there, because what I want to get at is giving birth is so personalized, such an important moment in life of a woman and parents, still you suffer from, I can at least imagine, staff shortages, not enough time to individually connect with them, because it's only a window of, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 hours that you can dedicate, and then you need to see the next patient. So there is not an abundance of availability of time and material. How can you make that a great experience or a greater mm-hmm. experience going forward?
Yeah, it's very interesting. I've done a big lean management project throughout my clinics to, you know, look at what we do every day and to verify if it's important or not and if it has an effect on the outcome, patient's health and patient's satisfaction. And from that point, you can, as a team, you can, you know, get time to be with patients and be with expectant mothers, for example. That's just one side effect I wanted to mention. But, you know, I also think birth is like a central moment in the life of families and women, and pregnancy also. And yet sometimes, you know, pregnancy and birth is not part of our society. It's done behind closed doors, and we have a very strange look on birth also. We either say it's very, you know, it's all pink and fluffy and beautiful, or we say it's a bloody thing and it's awful and painful, you know, and there's nothing in between. We do not take like a normal look on giving birth, which I think is important. We need to inform women on, you know, what they can expect, and to just, you know, be as informed as they can to have a good birth and to have a good experience. And we also have obstetrics as such in Germany, for example, is not part of the hospital reform right now. There was no expert who was an expert as a midwife or an obstetrician in the hospital reform, even though we have 700,000 people giving birth each year, and plus all the women who have abortions and miscarriages. You know,
they come on top.
We have more than 1 million people each year that are directly pregnant, plus their partners, makes 2 million people in Germany each year that are pregnant. And still, we don't have this focus on them. And in the hospital reform, we focus on people with insults of the brain, which I think is really important. But those are 200,000 people each year. And if we compare them to those 2 million people who are pregnant each year, so there's a big gap. We should focus more on obstetrics and also reflect families that they are important for us as a society. Young women, they do not want to give birth. They don't want to build families anymore because they see, I have an unequal care work. I need to do all the care work. I lose my job maybe, or
limit my chances.
Yeah, lose my chances.
Yeah, yeah.
And this might have effects on my whole life. Studies show women who are single are more happy than women who are in partnerships, which is the reverse effect for men. So we should really ask us as a society, do we make it attractive for young people to create families? And well, in Berlin, you don't find apartments easy as a family. So, you know, those are all aspects, and we should take that into consideration, because it's not just medicine, it's always also political. And so what I think what we could do is to take pregnancy and birth into society and to put it into our thoughts always, and to make it strong and to empower women as much as we can. So they have midwives that can accompany them during their births and have a strong birth. Yes.
So giving them much more of a voice in society, but also medical associations making reforms and the alike, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what it sounds very much like. Can I just ask around? I mean, you're coming direct from seeing a patient, sitting here with your traditional doctor's clothes. So coming really out of the clinic, to what extent do you already leverage technology these days? And is there also a big lever in leveraging technology much more to take away labor intense documentation and the like, to focus on what really matters, the time with the patient, where you can kind of have a dialogue.
Yeah, I won a big digitalization project, and I got some funding for my clinic, and I could digitalize some aspects of my clinics, which was really worth it. And for example, we did digitalized all the documentation and CTGs, which means the heart rate of the baby, and many things. And so that was really helpful because for me, everything machine or digitalization can do or a computer can do is good for me and gives me time to do the things I need to do as a human and the things that cannot be digitalized, for example, talking to patients, be empathetic and so on. And so this I find really helpful. So computer assistant technology is really good. Digitalization. I really like working with robot surgery, for example, or robots that help me do the visits from the patients where I can jump on digitally and go to the patient and talk to her.
Interesting. Cool. Yeah. So innovation happening on the ground, actually, which is great to hear. Probably fast forwarding from giving birth to menopause, another big area in women's health, at least increasingly big, because it is getting more and more socially recognized. And the symptoms affect sleep, mood, but many other aspects of life. And those symptoms often appear also well before menopause itself, making it hard for many women to find an effective diagnostic, but also treatment, as they frequently are misdiagnosed or inaccurately diagnosed. How do you assess the current state of menopause research, and what steps can be taken to increase its awareness among healthcare providers, from gynecologists all the way to general practitioners?
That's also a very interesting topic. There are 9 million women in Germany who are menopausal, and there's also smart activists who put focus on menopause. And I really like that because, you know, it's another way of making women visible, caring for them, making them stronger. And there are so many aspects to menopause. One is that women tend to get out of their workplace because they don't feel well and their workplaces are not adapted for this period of their lives. So they also get lost economically for our country. So this needs to be addressed also. But this is just one aspect, you know. There are many more. And we do have research concerning menopause, also strong research. The problem is that we tend to also not ask or not look out of the perspective of the women. We did not know what kind of symptoms do they have, because we thought they might have this and that symptom, and this and that symptom might be important to them, but we did not really, you know, ask the patients. So it turns out there are so many symptoms, and some young women also suffer from menopause, but when you go through your mid-30s, you might already have symptoms. And then,
or that early, really?
Mid-30s. Yes, you because then also, for example, fertility declines, which might not be pathological. You know, menopause is just an integrated contraception from evolution. You know, it's something good. It's there to protect women from giving birth when they're older, because this is not good for their bodies. And so this is something good. But and also then menopause medically, there's menopause medically, but then we also have biographical implications in this time of their lives, of women's lives. For example, their children might have been grown and leave the house, and maybe they see some chances that they have not taken and everything. So it's not only a medical time, but also a biographical, has biographical aspects. So this is what we can do. We can try to, you know, understand women as such and always ask us, what do they need and how can we help them? How can we make them stronger? How can we make their workplaces suitable for them? How can we make them stronger? How can we help them age healthier?
Understood. No, completely makes sense. Thanks for sharing that. I'm very astonished by the 9 million women in Germany only that do suffer at various stages of menopause. I mean, it's a huge market as well, right? Mm-hmm. So is there a one-size-fits-all hormone replacement therapy for the 9 million, or also there, does it need an individualization?
Yes, it's very interesting because many women do have symptoms, but also many women do not suffer at all. Mm-hmm. They just, you know, go through that phase and don't need any treatment. But there also we need to talk to the patients and ask them, what do you need? What do you expect from medicine? What do you expect from your life to change or to be better? And then we can help them. And some of them might need hormone replacement therapy, but some might just don't need it or need local therapy, you know, and that might be all.
Again, we're coming back to we need to listen into patients mm-hmm. and their wishes rather than making just a broad brush decision for them.
Yes.
So patriarchal medicine, I want to just briefly also jump there. It's a term that is often used also by yourselves in discussion about gynecology, where treatment can differ significantly from urology, as we touched before. What I found very interesting also preparing for today is that in prostate cancer, efforts are truly made to preserve erectile function, whereas when women undergo hysterectomy, it happens without fully understanding the implications for their own bodies, but also sexuality. There seems to be a huge disparity, just listening and seeing this. But what is it also not working against urology, but rather what can be learned from urology to transform also gynecology into a more balanced let's say matriarchal medicine?
Yes, that would be great. You know, I started to study in 1997, which was only 87 years after the first woman was able to study at my university, which is, you know, like not even a blink of evolution, like a very short time. So medicine was very patriarchal because there were only men and we only had this male perspective, which is not bad because it achieved so many things and we do have a very strong medicine. But now we come to the conclusion that it could be even stronger and even better if we allow other perspectives as well, for example, a female perspective. And we can, you know, now do a certain benchmarking and say, we have come very far. What can we do to equalize medicine and to have it as strong for other patients as we do have it for maybe male patients? But even male patients have disadvantages from patriarchal medicine, and we need to, you know, look at this also to individualize their therapy and to help them have a stronger health also. So this is what we can do. We can always, you know, look out of the perspective of patients and have an individualized medicine to make it stronger and to become better in general.
And listening to kind of the journey that we just made throughout the life, from birth to menstruation, menopause and old age and the like, it really seems like a lot has been happening when it comes to digitization, taking labor-intense documentation out of your hospitals at least, mm-hmm. and equaling one, more listening to patients' needs and wishes. But at the same time, a lot still to be done in terms of inequality, in terms of health system struggles that we're seeing day in, day out. That said, right, fast forward 5 years from now, mm-hmm. if we were to meet again here in Berlin, hopefully as sunny as today, what is it that you would wish has changed until then? And what is probably the minimum that you would expect has changed?
Well, I would really hope that we have a stronger digitalization, that we are able to, you know, check on all the information that one patient has had, and that I can, if I treat a patient, that I can look at it and conclude from it and to be better to treat this patient. So a better digitalization, more efficiency and, you know, less anarchy in medicine, then we could also strengthen self-examination. I think, you know, this this whole concept, we go to a doctor and sit there and wait and then only have small amounts of information step by step. This is something very strange to me, because mm-hmm. in no other field we have, we only get little information and we need to wait and more information about our bodies. So maybe this could change self-examinations that we could discuss with our doctors with video conferences and video calls, and way less examinations in general, and talking medicine or speaking medicine to be strengthened, to really empower people to become healthier. Those are my four aspects that we hopefully achieve in the next 5 years.
Let's see whether we can revisit in 5 years from now and hope for the best. Thanks yes. very much for your time, Mandy.
Yeah, it was my pleasure.
That really concludes also today's episode. Thank you for listening, everybody. We hope you enjoyed the discussion and are looking forward to what's next. If you found this episode insightful, please subscribe to our podcast and share it with your network. Through your support, we're enabled to bring important topics and important conversations such as the one that we had today to a broader audience. That's it. Until next time, and take care.
Strategy and Strategy made real.